Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 276 of Registry Matters. Good evening. Happy Saturday. Happy Saturday to everybody in chat. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm all right. Lots of chores today. Changed the oil in my car. That's always a fun chore. You probably don't do that. Have you ever changed oil in a car?
I think I did back in the 70s, yes.
How, like, you must have had to use, like, some very bizarre archaic tools. Did you have to use, like, make tree tools or something?
No, as I remember, you had one large bolt at the bottom of the oil pan that you pulled a plug and the oil would drain from the unit. And then you had this filter remover that was kind of a circular tool that would clamp down on it. And you would put that around the filter and you would spin it and take the filter off.
Did you let the oil just go down the gutter into the sewer, into the water runoff?
No, not even those days. You collected really? It in a pan and you took it to the car shop.
Okay. All right. I was wondering, because I seem to remember in my youth that that was still a thing that you could do.
People did do that.
All right. Well, you have a similar story, maybe. At least it involves a car, does it not?
Are you talking about my special entertainment yesterday evening?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll try to make this a short story, but keep it funny. As I'm getting ready to leave the office yesterday, there was a woman with a child sitting on the asphalt near the edge of the property. And I can see a baby seat, and I can see what appears to be personal belongings and some grocery food items. And she's sitting there, and the clouds are rolling in, and it's about to have a storm. And I couldn't bring myself to pass her up, so I asked her, I said, you appear to be in distress. She said, I'm trying to get to a shelter. And I said, well, I'll take you to a shelter. Which one do you want to go to? I said, with a child, there's only certain shelters that take children. And she wasn't clear what shelter. And I said, well, what about Joy Junction? And so I recommended Joy Junction because they're a family shelter. And I said, I'll take you to Joy Junction. I said, well, before we make this trip, I want to make sure you understand. I have one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to get you to the shelter. If you have any other ideas, let's make sure we have those on the table because that is all I'm offering. And she said, oh, no. And I said, but I have one stop to make at the post office. I'm just finishing the week's work, and I'm delivering mail to the post office. And I said, but it will be en route. As we go to the post office, I go into the post office and deliver the mail inside. And then as I get back in the car, the rain comes. And it comes. You know, we have really heavy rains at times, even though it's a desert. And the rain comes. I said, well, aren't you glad that I happened to come along here? And I said, would you please Google up Joy Junction? Because I wanted her to know that I was taking her the correct route and not out, off to be axe murdered.
Reasonable. Okay.
And she was fiddling and fiddling and fiddling with the phone. I said, would you please Google Joy Junction? And of course, I know how to get there. But I wanted to make sure she knew that we were going to the shelter. And she couldn't seem to Google it. So I Googled it up. I said, we're going to follow these directions. And we were following the directions until we encountered a road closure that Google didn't know about, which threw me way off because I had to take an alternate route. And then there was construction on the alternate route, which I tried to bypass the construction. And as I did that, I got way off course. And we eventually got back to where we were trying to go to get to the shelter. And I took her and I pulled into this long road, and it's called Joy Junction Road. Can you imagine that?
Okay.
And so I'm going up this road, and I'm going due west, and the sun is still up because it's like 6:15, 6:30. Sun hasn't set, and the sun is directly in my eyes, and I don't see this guard shack, but I can see the automatic arm that goes up and down. I can see that, and I'm thinking, well, maybe this thing works automatically. It'll detect the car, and I'll be able to go in. But no, the guy yells out, Can I help you? And so I looked over to my left, and the guard shack was like 20 feet away.
Really?
I was nowhere near the guard shack. And I was at least 15 feet away from the guard shack. So I put the position in my car, and I said, I'm trying to find shelter for a woman and a child. And he's giving me this horrible, dreadful look, like you're looking for a family shelter for a man and a woman and a child, which is something that most shelters frown upon, because it takes critical space if you have to provide family shelter. So they typically split families. They put the men into a men's dorm. They put the women into a women's dorm. And a child below a certain age, it doesn't matter about gender because they're not thinking along those lines. So
right.
That's what they typically do. And so he's giving me this dreadful look. And I said, no, it's not for me. I said, it's just for the woman and the child. And, oh, okay. He said, well, did you have a reservation? Has she cleared background? And I said, no, we don't have a reservation, and she has a cleared background. And he said, well, she's got a clear background. And, of course, that fits into the PFR narrative, right? You can't go to a shelter if you're a PFR.
Right.
So I looked over to her, and I said, does the background come up okay? Will it come up okay? She said, yes. I said, okay.
Of course she said yes, Larry.
Well, there would be no need. There would be no need for you to say yes if it wasn't going to.
Just to hopefully you squeak through, though.
How would you do that with the computerization we have?
I get you, but person would be like, well, maybe they won't run it this time. But continue. Well, I don't mean to interrupt your story.
So I gave her passed her ID into the guard shack, and he gets on a radio, and he calls in her vitals, her date of birth, and her full spelling of her name, letter by letter. Very uncommon name. And so I said, well, I appreciate you processing her because, you know, I don't want to leave her out with nowhere to go. So I'm waiting. I said, how long does this take? I said, it's not going to be weeks or days. He said, no, it'll be pretty fast. So within a few minutes, they sent a person out. Now, they didn't want me on that property, and I don't think it had anything to do with me, per se. They didn't want anybody that was not authorized on the property. So they sent this gentleman out to take her belongings, to take her into the shelter, to her quarters, and process her. So this guy comes out. He says, you good to go? He said, I'll help you get your stuff. So she has some groceries she just bought with her SNAP benefits. And she's got this bag full of food. He said, you can't carry that in there. And I looked, I said, so she can't take any of her food? He said, no, we feed people here. I said, well, yeah, I know you feed people, but I don't know if you provide snacks. And you know, he said, nope, no food. I said, well, what about her baby formula? Can she? Oh, yeah, she can have that. And And I said, okay. And I said, well, I'll keep your food items for you. And I said, you can reconnect. If we connect again, I'll give you your food. And I said, I'll keep the stuff for you. And but I was surprised that they were so rigid about security. You know, we hear this from the PFRs about security and checking people's background. But, man, they weren't going to let her anywhere on that property until they had their background check done. And her being a 25-year-old woman with a baby, can you imagine how they would treat a man?
Can imagine.
So basically, you'd be screwed if you tried to get shelter. And
yeah.
So I see it firsthand now how it works. That's what they do.
Do you think, though, even with the, if it's an evacuation situation, you know, there's a storm hitting the Northeast coast right now. Do you think that when there's evacuations of a town, a county, whatever, that they're doing background checks like that for the, I don't know, 15,000 residents or something like that are going to shelters?
I have been told that in the states that are prone to storm activity that they actually do, like in a Louisiana or a Florida.
Yeah.
But I can't say on the Northeast seaboard where they're less likely for that to happen, that they'd be set up for it. But I've been told that that's what they do. And the PFRs have to go to separate evacuation locations, which are sometimes correctional facilities, to wait for the special evacuation to take them.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that they put the PFRs, even if it's in a normal shelter, that they put them in a special place. They'll put them in like somebody's office or something like that, so they're sequestered on their own.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. And the funny thing is that most of these shelters, like this one, the Joy Junction, is definitely Christian-based. I know the founder, who's now deceased, but I met him when I worked for the Conference of Churches, and he was a great guy from New York. And he was totally committed to providing shelter. And I think he would be rolling over in his grave if he knew that they're being that rigid now, turning away people if they have anything on their background. I just don't think that he would be in approval he would approve of that.
Well, all right. Well, look, Larry, so now I may have to change your picture from being Dr. Doom or whatever his name is with the mechanical heart. Maybe you do have something of a soft spot on your heart somewhere. Maybe. That may turn away listeners faster than you talking about conservatives, though.
It might, but I figure the same thing applies when people... We spend billions and billions and billions of dollars rescuing animals. And the justification is that the poor animal didn't do anything wrong, that they can't help it. Yep. And I bought into your doctrine there. But that poor baby that was out getting ready to be doused in a downpour didn't do anything wrong either. And if your doctrine means anything, you would react the same way to a human being that you react to the little puppy.
I agree. Yeah, you could perhaps say that the 25-year-old brought her plight on herself, but the baby didn't do anything, so we should make sure that the baby's taken care of. So then maybe you put mom out on the corner and bring the baby in.
Yeah, but that cost even more when we separate a child and put them in state custody. So the more economical thing is to put them in shelter. But hopefully it works out for her. She wants to get back to Texas, and I told her that depending on the cost, I might can help her with that. And also I want to validate, make sure that she's going to a legitimate place in Texas and it's not just a scam to get a free ticket and then cash in the ticket. And she actually is going to need a ticket for the child because it's a 30-hour bus ride. And I don't think you can hold a 1.5-year-old for 30 hours in your lap.
Probably not. You're going to need a baby. And are we talking like 6-month-old or something like that?
Baby somewhere between 1.5 and 2.
Oh, yeah. You're not holding them. God, that kid's going to run around, too.
Yep, so she's going to need a ticket for the child, and
yeah,
it's not going to be an easy thing to do. And apparently her mother doesn't have any financial resources, and that's her version. And I like to verify things, so if she calls me, I may ask her for contact information on her mother, and she'll at least have to get someone to pretend like they're her mother and make sure they sound old enough to be a mother.
All right. Well, with that 5-minute story out of the way, can you give us a rundown of what's going on this evening?
Well, I'm going to have to do it from memory since I didn't change my notes, but we have a case from the United States District Court in Connecticut dealing with internet identifiers. We're going to get into that. And then we've got a case from the Louisiana Supreme Court that deals with correcting a sentence for an unjust conviction. And we have a listener question, and I think you plopped in a listener question. So we've got 2 listener questions, and we've got 2 cases.
Very good. Well, let us begin with a question from a incredibly longtime patron. One of the earliest ones. His name is Mike. I'd like to hear Larry's opinion on his governor thinking she can limit constitutional rights by just declaring an emergency. If he agrees with it, does it extend to forcing you to house troops in your home? And give up the right to trial by jury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That's a great question. We talked about that, you and I did, a couple of days ago.
Correct.
And the governor issued an executive order for 30 days to apply to Albuquerque and Bernalillo County that would suspend the Second Amendment for people who have concealed carry permits, and it would also suspend the open carry law, which anybody can carry that's lawfully entitled to possess a weapon that's not a prohibited individual can carry openly. Now, truthfully, if you carry openly in an urban area like Albuquerque, you're going to get attention of the cops. Now, if you're out in Torrance County or someplace more remote and rural, probably not. But if you're carrying in an urban area, if you're under 30 years of age, they probably wouldn't say much to me unless the officer recognized me because I'm old and I look like I'm okay. But if you, as a normal person under 30, you start running around, even though it's lawful, they're going to want to know if that gun is stolen. They're going to want to ask you questions, and they're going to want to find out if you have any warrants or anything that they can take you into custody for. But in terms of his question, I was very disturbed by that order. I don't support it per se, but I think I understand the governor, why she did what she did. She doesn't learn a whole lot from her mistakes. She's been taken to court a number of times on things, and each time the court slaps her down, that doesn't seem to change her behavior. But in this instance, she's struggling because there doesn't seem to be anything other than thoughts and prayers. That's the solution that's offered every time these tragedies happen. And most recently, a child was killed after a baseball game with someone spraying out bullets indiscriminately. And there's been a significant number of tragic deaths related to firearms with unattended weapons that children have picked up. And the governor's trying to up the discussion beyond thoughts and prayers. I get that. But the governor also placed her hand on that Bible, and she also swore to uphold constitutions of the United States and the state of New Mexico. And she doesn't really have that power. And as of now, that order has been placed on hold until October 3rd by a federal judge appointed by President Biden. And it's been placed on hold, and they will be having a hearing to determine if that's temporary restraining order is going to become a preliminary injunction. And I expect it will become a preliminary injunction afterwards, because I can't think of any way to justify constitutionally what she's doing, although I understand her motivation. She's sick and tired of nothing but talk, and she's trying to provoke a discussion. And she has provoked a discussion, all right, but it's not what she wanted to have discussed. They're discussing her impeachment.
Do you think, wouldn't this eventually, if you have some sort of mass outbreak of violence, wouldn't you eventually be able to use the freedom of speech with saying something like a bomb? Like, you're not allowed to say those kinds of words in airports and movie theaters because it might incite a riot, or, you know, there is a case to be made against public safety that you could suspend pieces of the Constitution in lieu of that.
Possibly. I think we've played a clip of Justice Scalia saying something along that line, but we're not at that level yet, and it's hard to identify when we hit that level. How many children have to die? How many people have to die? What would constitute that level of pandemonium where you'd be justified? I don't know where that line would be, but I don't think we're there yet. The governor could always call a special session.
Okay.
And she could place specific items on the legislative agenda. She knows they're not going to pass, but she could do that.
What's your political calculation there if it's not going to work?
Well, I look at how often it's been tried, and we've had some success getting a red flag law through in terms of trying to put some distance between people buying weapons that may have mental health issues. And the NRA comes in with resources that you cannot imagine when you start talking about anything. They claim they're coming for your guns, and they have their talking points and their operation. It generates, the email volume has been significant, not as drastic as I would expect, but there's been significant email volume coming in about impeach the governor. Well, the funny thing is they can't, because they're not in session. And therefore, the only way they could get into session would be the governor call a special session, and the governor is not likely to call a special session for her impeachment. Would you think that would be a long shot?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so she's not going to call a special session with the topic being impeachment. Then they have another tool that requires a super majority. I think it's two-thirds or three-quarters, but it's a super majority to call a special extraordinary session, as it's called. And we've only had, I think, one in the history of the state, a sort of extraordinary session that's called by the lawmakers themselves. And they cannot ever get to that level of support for an extraordinary session. The Republicans are basically just one vote shy in each of our chambers of being a supermajority. The Democrats almost have a supermajority in both houses. So they can't get to that number. So they're not going to be able to call themselves into session. So all they can do is wait until the regular session convenes in January, which is, guess what? It's a short session. And guess who sets the agenda in a short session? Wow, the governor. I have a doubt in my mind that she's going to put her impeachment on the legislative call.
I see. I gotcha.
So
interesting.
That ain't going anywhere, folks. Get over it. You're not going to impeach her. The support's not going to be there. But it has caused a lot of discussion. There's a lot of it's hot news that the governor has suspended the Constitution, but it's been halted by the court.
Very well. Let's move along to another listener question that goes, given my situation in Wisconsin, I wish I could say it gets better. Still wearing the ankle monitor despite the Supreme Court ruling. The Supreme Court attempted to correct the statute's interpretation regarding what is considered a repeat habitual sex offender. And just to provide a little bit more, the Wisconsin statute has been clarified. Why is this person still on GPS monitoring, Larry?
Well, my understanding is that he has two convictions in separate cases in the state of Texas. And this comports with the language of the statute in Wisconsin. He has multiple convictions in separate cases. Now, that's my understanding. We have not spoken personally, but he's written a number of things on YouTube, and I'm going by my memory that he has multiple convictions. His version is that the prosecutor filed another charge after the first case was filed. But anyway, it comports with the language of the statute. So that's why he's still on the monitor.
He pointed out that two or more convictions does not make a person a repeat offender, as most prosecutors take the shotgun approach.
Well, I agree with that, but they do take the shotgun approach. But based on the statute as it's currently in place, two or more convictions in separate cases, that does indeed make a person a repeat offender. And the AG's opinion letter that has been debunked now by the state Supreme Court had stated that two or more counts in the same case makes the person a repeat offender. It does not. But my understanding is he has two separate cases.
And the listener also stated if an individual was arrested, charged, convicted, sentenced, then reoffended, that is a habitual offender. Why is it so hard to understand there, Larry? As I've been wearing this ankle monitor for 5 years, the answer is, again, civil liability. I haven't had any issues with law enforcement or the criminal justice system since my release in 2006. Public safety is not an issue. The statute was misinterpreted, and now they do not want to admit their mistakes. Oops, sorry for the last 5 years.
Oh, well, it's not hard to understand. They do not want to admit their mistakes. The AG's opinion letter has now been declared wrong as a matter of law. But if there are two separate case numbers that are resolved on different dates, that seems to qualify under strict interpretation of the statute as two or more convictions. So it's not hard to understand at all.
And we don't know necessarily all the facts of his case. And he says that the prosecutor filed a second case?
Yes, and that's their option to do that. Sometimes the public disclosure of a prosecution can lead to additional victims coming forward. And when those victims come forward, the prosecutor often files those charges. What is the prosecutor supposed to do? Say, well, doesn't matter that four more people came forward. We ain't filing nothing. We done filed our case and we're done. I mean, of course they're going to file them. Now, if they filed more charges related to that same victim, that is a little bit different. And that perhaps should have been challenged by the defense attorney in Texas at the time. If they merely said, oh, well, you're not going to take our plea offer. Well, we only filed one count. We're going to file brand new cases. What you would normally do in a case like that is you would file a superseding indictment or in some cases, not an indictment, depends on the state. You might file a new information, as it's called. But that would still, those old charges, if you found two or three more counts from the same victim, they would typically be resolved in the same case. So there again, those facts were lacking.
What do you think he should do then? What are his options?
Well, he's certainly got a real problem for sure, because he's got this device strapped on him and he's got a very old conviction and he finds this device annoying and expensive and inconvenient. So we certainly understand that. He could file an action in Wisconsin challenging the GPS statute. Unfortunately, that may not be the best option because the law is the law and it says what it says. But having the law declared unconstitutional will be difficult for sure. But that's not to say it's impossible. Got to remember, there's the Grady decision on North Carolina decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which held that GPS tracking is certainly a search and seizure. And as we all know, searches generally must be based on an individualized articulation of facts. And since Wisconsin law has not done an individualized assessment, they're just saying you have two convictions, he might gain traction with such a challenge. That would be option number one. He could possibly, it's a really long shot, but he could go back to Texas and try to challenge the original conviction. But I have a feeling he's out of time on that. That's so long ago that he's not going to get any traction trying to go back and reopen a 20-year-old conviction in Texas and saying that something was done wrong decades ago.
And it's probably the time to throw in the obligatory disclaimer that, just a reminder, that FYP Education and this podcast registry matters. It's not a law firm, and we can't do the litigation. Even though, Larry, you are probably the most adept, astute, savvy, sophisticated, there's a whole bunch of other words in there, legal strategist that could be known to man. You just don't carry that little Esquire thing after your name.
Well, why don't you buy me one of those and I can carry it?
Could we find some place that just like sells online degrees and give you like a law degree and you could have the Esquire just cause?
Well, there's a bunch of liberal do-gooders out in Oregon, I think, that are trying to make it easier for people that have not gone to law school to sit for the bar. And I think Vermont allows that now if you have the requisite number of hours of legal experience. But I'm not in either one of those liberal lefty states.
Bastards.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Moving along then. We have a case from the Courthouse News Service from Connecticut. I'm going to set it up a little bit, so hold your horses. I know that you're going to go ballistic on how I describe it, but here we go. It has to do with a law that requires disclosure of email addresses and internet identifiers. The first sentence of the story reads as follows. Although he declined to grant class-wide relief, the federal judge determined Thursday that disclosure of online aliases chilled PFR's ability to communicate freely. My recollection is that you weren't really a big fan of this case, but he did win. So we have to then mark it on the calendar as you were wrong. Can you admit it?
I can admit that he has a fantastic victory, at least for now. So based on the evidence we have, it would appear as though my assessment was wrong, yes. But another good point worthy of mentioning is that the judge also pointed out Connecticut has yet to use the law to prevent or detect any criminal activity. That seems to undermine the state's argument for the law itself, and that'll become clear to you why I'm making that point as we go through this.
Very well. The article states, U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Meyer, a Barack Obama appointee, acknowledged at the outset of his opinion that Connecticut General Statutes 54-251 paragraph A and 54-253 paragraph B do not bar anyone from speaking, but nevertheless agreed with the plaintiff's James Cornelio, the laws burden his First Amendment rights. And what did he base that on?
Well, the judge stated by compelling plaintiff to disclose to the state police all his email addresses, social media accounts, and other internet communication identifiers, such as the names he uses if he comments on an online news article, the judge said the law chills and inhibits his right to speak freely on the internet and do so anonymously if he wishes. That's what the judge said for now.
The law was passed in 2007 and imposes felony criminal punishment on PFRs who refuse to disclose the identifiers at the time of their registration, or if they fail to provide updates if any online aliases change during their registration period. Did Cornelio get prosecuted for a violation?
Yes, and just, I don't think I put the case name in there, but it's Cornelio is the name of the challenger. So that's Cornelio. Yes, Cornelio was arrested in Connecticut in 2018 after he sent emails to the state police from an email address not disclosed to the state. I'd have to say that that's a bit reckless to send emails to the police from a non-registered account.
It's kind of like the things where the people go to the registry office multiple times saying, are you sure I don't have to register? And then they get busted for it. Like, if you just left the thing alone and had you been diligent and always sent email from the one that they know about, he wouldn't have a problem. What was the outcome of that prosecution?
According to the story, the criminal case was eventually dismissed, and Cornelio filed the pro se lawsuit in federal court to challenge the disclosure of law on First Amendment grounds.
And you love pro se.
I do.
And I remember this. So the judge finally dismissed the suit on the basis that the state had a legitimate reason to monitor PFRs to prevent and detect additional crimes, but the Second Circuit reversed upon finding he had misapplied intermediate scrutiny. How did the Second Circuit come to that decision?
Well, the appeals court determined that the state was required to provide evidence the law either deterred or had been used to ferret out criminal activity. Now, remember, when First Amendment, and you have a lot less freedom, you're not just looking at the rational basis test. You're all at least at an intermediate scrutiny. And upon reconsideration, Judge Meyer agreed with Cornelio that the state had failed to do so. The judge stated the state's burden here is to make some evidence-based showing of a causal nexus between disclosure requirement and the important government interest. But the state has not adduced any probative evidence in this causal nexus issue. So they didn't do much to try to prove their case.
Would you do me a favor? And so strict scrutiny is unconstitutional on the face. Is that, did I summarize that right?
Very close. It's the toughest constitutional standard. When you're restricting content of speech, that is going to be strict scrutiny.
And then what is intermittent scrutiny?
Intermediate is the next level beneath that, where you're restricting maybe the access channels to speech, but you're not telling people what they can say. So in an intermediate scrutiny, you've got a tough standard, but not as tough as strict scrutiny. But they didn't come close, according to the circuit court and now Judge Meyer.
Well, Judge Meyer went on to cite the state's own admission that the disclosure requirement has had no deterring effect and that it can cite no instance in which law enforcement officials were unable to apprehend an individual committing PFR-type crimes using the internet identifiers because they were unable to identify the person committing those crimes.
That's one thing he said, but Judge Meyer went further. He stated, despite providing examples of sex offenders who violated disclosure law and went on to commit additional sex crimes, Meyer emphasized that none of these criminals were apprehended because of the law.
That's pretty powerful, though. And he went on beyond that. According to Judge Meyer, the 15 years since the passage of the law has given the state more than enough time to gather evidence of their efficacy. But the dearth of expert testimony or concrete examples of its effectiveness is damning to its argument. And what do you say about that?
Now, you remember what you just read, the dearth of expert testimony.
Yep.
Now, I say that this is a great example of how summary judgment can benefit one party over the other. You remember both parties filed for cross motions for summary judgment. The state filed a cross motion for summary judgment as well. This means that all inferences must be resolved in favor of the non-moving party on their motion. The state asked for summary judgment and proclaimed that no material facts were in dispute. This means that any argument Cornelio would have made at trial regarding the lack of efficacy were presumed by the court to be true because those weren't developed in a confrontational setting. So this is where a summary judgment worked to Cornelio's favor.
I understand. I see how that can work that way. The judge stated, given Cornelio was arrested in the past for a violation of the statute, his First Amendment rights would undoubtedly be chilled if the state was allowed to continue its enforcement of the law. And so he granted Cornelio's motion for declaratory and injunctive relief. Can you explain both of those, please?
Sure. You hear me ask people, why don't you file a petition for declaratory judgment or declaratory relief? You're asking a court to declare your rights under the particular law that you don't particularly find satisfying to you, and you think it may not be constitutional. So you ask for a declaration. You don't wait for a prosecution. You ask the court to declare your rights. So that's what Cornelio did. He petitioned the court for declaratory relief saying, hey, this law shouldn't be applied to me because it's unconstitutional. So that's the declaratory judgment. The injunctive relief is a judicial order that prohibits the state in this instance from further enforcement. But when you ask for an injunction, kind of like what was granted to the governor, except it was a temporary restraining order because there hasn't been an adversarial proceeding between the parties on the gun ban. But you're asking the court to issue an order prohibiting any further movement by a party. And it's a tough standard to meet. But now Cornelio has gotten an injunction against the state of Connecticut. They cannot demand that he provide any of this information. And you have to admit that that's funny.
I think that's amazing. I would run out and I would make like 1,000 different accounts and I would start emailing my handler from all of them.
Well, I think he ought to do that. And this is an amazing victory for the moment. We'll have to see what the state does, but I'm very proud to see this.
The judge also then stated because Cornelia was the only party named in the complaint, which was not filed as a class action, the injunction to prevent enforcement of the law applies only to him and not other PFRs in the state. Why did he do that rather than providing broad relief to everyone?
My guess is that he chose not to be an activist judge. We don't like activist judges, right?
That's what I hear.
Well, the complaint before the court was on behalf of Mr. Cornelio, and there had been no effort to expand the plaintiff class or to seek class certification. So for the judge to order relief beyond the case at bar before him would have been the epitome of judicial activism. And we don't like that now, do we?
I believe that I've heard that we don't. I do got to wonder, though, wouldn't somebody be able to cite this as something of persuasive evidence in court if they did get jammed up for it?
Absolutely. And beyond that, it's going to be stronger than persuasive authority. It's going to be binding until there's a circuit review. If there is a circuit review, it's going to be binded in the whole state of Connecticut. But so, yes, this is good stuff.
So while it might not apply to them directly, it applies to them indirectly, and they'd be able to like wave the piece of paper of the order saying, no, don't do that. You're going to lose.
That would be correct. I doubt there'll be any prosecutions going forward at this point. Based on this is a very strongly worded order and it is binding. So if you were to file a case against someone as a defense attorney, that'd be the first thing I'd call the prosecutor and say, now you got to be aware. You got to be aware of Cornelio, right? Yes, I am. Well, do you really want to move forward this prosecution? Because I'm going to seek dismissal on constitutional grounds, and we're going to have to rehash the constitutionality. And every time you file one of these, we're going to have a constitutional argument. You ought to just dismiss the indictment, and I don't think they'll file anymore.
The judge seems to have telegraphed to the state that if they have a problem, he seems to have telegraphed to the state that they do have a problem. He wrote, "It is hard to see how the state could legitimately defend its application of the disclosure law against any other PFRs. The reason is that the law is invalid as to Cornelio would appear to apply with equal force to all other PFRs.
And he added, but Cornelio did not bring the action as a class action, and I am wary of taking the extraordinary step of granting relief to persons who are not parties before me.
Hey, I didn't realize, did Paul Dubling represent him?
He did at this stage, yes. After Mr. Cornelio did the work himself, he lost at the district court. He went up to the circuit court. He won at the circuit court. Then he came back to me and said, I told you so. I've got something here. And I snarled at him and said, well, just because you got a reversal at the circuit court doesn't mean you're going to prevail at the district court. I told him that just look at what happened over in the case that Richard Gladden did in Texas challenging the city of Louisville. He lost at the district court. He went to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit slapped the case back on the active docket. He went back to the district court. He lost again. He went back to the Fifth Circuit. He lost again. So I was very dismissive of it. And I said, the circuits are split on this. And I don't see this as something that we want to put a lot of our resources in because our resources are so limited. And he went ahead and said, well, I'm not giving up. And he went, found his own attorney, and he made their own agreement with Connecticut One Standard of Justice. And they did this case, and they deserve credit because they won.
That's amazing. So how was he able to represent the guy in Connecticut if he is from North Carolina?
That's through an admission process called pro hoc vice.
Pro hoc vice?
Yes.
And Dubling went on to state, I am pleased with the outcome and appreciate the court's consideration of these important issue. So what happens next?
We don't know, but the Connecticut Attorney General's office said it is, quote, reviewing the decision and evaluating the next steps. I'd say they have a very difficult decision to make. It will be tough to reverse this based on the Second Circuit's previous ruling. Also, it will be difficult to ignore the politics of this issue as well, especially if 2024 is an election year in which the AG must run for re-election. I can see this right now. If the Connecticut Attorney General's office is in play next year, and I'm a conservative wanting to take over that office from a liberal pointy head, I'm going to make this an issue. I'm going to say, well, this is an example of why you need to elect me. You've got this liberal lefty that won't even appeal this obviously blatantly bad decision that makes our communities less safe. And if you elect me, I'm going to fight for you. So Depending on the election posture in Connecticut, this could become a political issue. So that will weigh into their decision of whether they're going to continue fighting, because if you continue fighting, you're going to be able to push this beyond 2024. All you have to do is just file enough frivolous pleadings and argue about everything and ask for oral arguments and then file, ask for supplemental briefing. You can do all sorts of things to try to prolong the case, and you can easily stretch this beyond the 2024 election.
Now, I know that this is only one person in Connecticut, but it seems like the way that this may have come out would apply to other states. Again, I guess we go to something that's persuasive.
Well, it's not really that persuasive now, as it's just a district court decision. If the state does appeal and if the Second Circuit affirms, it is very persuasive. It's binding in that circuit, but it'll be very persuasive. But we still have a circuit split. We've had some circuits that have found that it's not an intrusion on speech. So eventually this case will have to go to the Supreme Court because of the split. And at some point, depending on how irritated the PFRs get, they'll take this matter to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And what would be your opinion of taking it up that high? To me, this feels like a breach. To me, it does. That you are afforded the right to be able to speak and speak anonymously if you wish. And if your name is, my name is John Doe, here's my social security number at gmail.com. You're not anonymous that way.
This is one of the rare instances where I have some faith in this Supreme Court on this issue. They've been fairly good on speech, and maybe they would do the right thing if this case were to go up to them.
Anything else before we move along to the next?
Well, let's just make sure that we give the accolades to One Standard of Justice, to Paul Dubling, and this is an amazing win. Did it end the registry? No, it didn't. But here's what people need to understand about the registry. We want to end as much of the things that the registry requires you to do that can result in prosecution. If we get the registry down to only one thing that can result in your prosecution, would be kind of like the young men registered for the draft. Only thing a young man that can be prosecuted for is failing to register. They can't be prosecuted for all the litany of things like what a PFR has to do and what they're precluded from doing. Every time you take away something that you can be prosecuted and sent to prison for, you've weakened the reach of the registry. So every little victory is significant. It's like I try to make the analogy when people say, I haven't lived in Florida for 27 years and I'm required to register. I say, no, you're not required to register there. You're listed on their website. They cannot prosecute you for any misconduct. They cannot apply any of the residency restrictions, any exclusionary zones. They can't require you to update all your information about where you're attending school and where you're working. All those things are not available to them to prosecute you for. You're listed on a website. There's nothing Florida can do to you because the website will show living out of state. And if Vermont discharged you from registration, you're not within any zone of prosecution in any state at that point. So it's not the same thing as being registered, and the hate mail will flow as it always does because I don't understand that people don't understand why I can't understand that being on the website is the same thing as being registered, and it isn't.
So. Just remember to email crackpot@registrymatters.ca. Just kidding. That's not an email address. Don't send anything there. Just kidding.
Well.
All right. Well, you then want to discuss a case from the Louisiana Supreme Court, and the case is State versus William Lee. And not surprising, Larry, it's a little convoluted, and I'm not sure how you even remotely think that it's relevant to PFRs.
Well, did you read it?
Well, the article you sent me is like one paragraph long. And then it says, read the ruling here. So I'm going to go with no.
No, you didn't read it. Okay. Well, you should read these from cover to cover multiple times.
It was a busy, busy day.
All right. So, well, it's relevant because it reduces the opportunity for a bad and unjust conviction to be undone. Based on this decision, only the governor can provide a person with clemency if this decision, the way I read it, it's pretty much saying that what happened in this case cannot happen again. And the prosecutors were trying to do the right thing in this case. And now it's up to the governor. The governors are elected in all the states, as far as I know.
Yep.
And in Louisiana now, it's on the executive branch. What do you think the odds would be of a PFR that was wrongfully convicted of a governor in Louisiana, particularly, providing any type of clemency or relief to that person? So that's where the relevance
is. Yes. It's going to be a womp, womp, womp kind of sound. It begins with, we granted the writ application in this case to address the issue of constitutionality, whether Article 930.10 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, which governs post-conviction plea agreements, violates the state's constitution's separation of powers provision. More specifically, the question presented is whether Article 930.10 permits the judicial branch to exercise the governor's power to pardon a final conviction. What's this all about?
Well, it's a case about judicial activism, in my opinion, except it's not the kind of activism that we generally would like. This is activism, adverse activism, but this is some judicial activism, I think.
And of course, Larry, you know that there's no judicial activism in a conservative state. You're smoking that wacky weed again. Let me provide you with some background. On October 20th, 2003, the state charged defendant William Wayne Lee Jr. with one count of second-degree murder. Following the trial, on February 9th, 2007, a unanimous jury found Lee guilty as charged. The court sentenced Lee to life imprisonment at hard labor without benefit of probation, parole, or suspension of sentence. The conviction and sentence were affirmed on appeal. And what happened to bring this back to court?
Well, on October 5th, 2021, Mr. Lee and the district attorney filed a joint motion to amend the conviction and sentence. In the motion, the parties stipulated certain facts relating to the cause of the victim's death. They agreed that new evidence obtained in May 2020 would have bolstered Lee's case at trial by supporting the defense theory that the victim's fatal injuries were caused by her falling on her own accord. Based on this new evidence, the parties agreed that a fair and just resolution of the case would be to amend Lee's conviction from second-degree murder to manslaughter and for the court to vacate his life sentence without parole and impose a sentence of 35 years imprisonment at hard labor. They love that hard labor in Louisiana.
Oh my God. I can't imagine. It's like 1,000 degrees with 1,000% humidity. It would be pretty brutal. Well, so far so good. And then what?
Well, the motion was heard in the district court in January 2022. And at the hearing, the assistant district attorney announced his office was submitting on what's contained in the joint motion. And I guess that means agreeing to. I just put it exactly like it was in the decision. And then Lee's lawyer summarized the pleading. The district court granted the relief of requesting a joint motion and without finding any legal defect in the conviction. And that is apparently required in a separate section of Louisiana Rules of Criminal Procedure at 930.3. And the judge went on and vacated Lee's second-degree murder conviction and the previously imposed life sentence. And this is what happened next. And they imposed a 35-year sentence and credit for time served.
I'm guessing that some other party intervened with the case. So what happened?
That is correct. Another party did intervene. And on March 9, 2022, the Attorney General of Louisiana filed a pleading entitled Motion and Incorporated Memorandum to Vacate Post-Conviction Plea Agreement as Unconstitutional. So the Attorney General jumped in and said, whoa, you can't do that. And the Attorney General argued that Article 930.10 is unconstitutional, permits the court to grant clemency to criminal defendants. And he says that's a power that's expressly and exclusively granted to the governor.
I see that. So then the court stated, by signing the pleading, the district attorney indicated he did not oppose the filing of the motion. And from this, we infer that the district attorney acquiesced in the attorney general's entry into the proceedings to allow the district court to consider the issue. And why would the district attorney not object to the AG's motion?
Well, my guess would be more than likely he would have deemed it politically risky to fight the AG. The AG has a bigger megaphone. They serve statewide. And the AG can usually command a news audience at any time. And for him to say, well, you think it's unconstitutional. That's your job to think things are unconstitutional. Well, by golly, this is my territory down here, and you butt out. I just don't see that that's a politically sustainable and viable position. So I think that's probably why the district attorney did not object.
Then on June 15th of 2022, after hearing on the merits, the district court denied the attorney general's motion and found that the article 930.10 does not violate Louisiana's constitution. In its reasons, the court found that the statute does not interfere with the separation of powers and does not infringe upon the governor's right to issue clemency. That seems sufficient to me in my layperson's understanding of things.
Well, it does seem sufficient, but it to me as well. But the court explained that it did not view the procedure as tossing the jury's finding out. Did I jump the gun here?
No.
Yeah, I didn't. I was thinking, gee, I'm having a senior moment. That's what the state was arguing. And the trial court said that they did not view the procedure as tossing the jury's finding out. Rather, the court found it was intended to be used in cases like this where there's new evidence that could possibly result in a new trial. And that seems reasonable to me, but not to the Attorney General.
And the issue here is that Article 930.10 permits courts to overturn a defendant's final conviction and then accept their guilty plea and impose the agreed-to sentence. Article 930.10 allows a court to reverse a conviction merely because the defendant and the district attorney jointly requested the court to do so.
You are correct. That's what the law says, and that's what they did. But the Attorney General found problems with that law. And so you're correct. The parties need not assert, nor is this court required, to find any legal defect requiring relief. And the Supreme Court doesn't agree with that, and they held that Article 930.10 serves to upend the work of the jury, the prosecutor, and the judge in the trial of the case without identifying any defect in these proceedings. Contrary to the observation of the district court, a post-conviction plea agreement pursuant to Article 930.10 is tossing out the jury's finding, according to the state Supreme Court, and the Constitution only authorizes the governor to take such action. And that's what this issue is about. Was that 932.1, that section that allowed this to be done, was that an intrusion in the governor's exclusive powers? And the state of Louisiana said, yes, it is.
And then they said, for these reasons, we hold that Article 930.10 permits courts to exercise the governor's exclusive power to pardon those convicted of crimes, a violation of the separation of powers provision in the Constitution. What do you think Lee should have done instead?
Well, I'm really confused, too, because the statute provided that, the criminal procedure article provided that, and it seems to have accomplished exactly what it was intended to do. To correct something that was wrong. There didn't necessarily have to be a defect. New evidence was not necessarily a defect. That evidence was not available at that time, so the jury didn't get to consider it. It seems to be a proper what happened. But while I was reading this, I noticed that there are two options for post-conviction, and that's Article 930.10 and then 930.30, which you can read, which is what is left in Louisiana, and this seems like going to be a very difficult needle to thread to get relief under this article if the 930.10 is unconstitutional.
Article 930.3 provides, oh boy, here comes legal speak, so bear with me. If the petitioner is in custody after sentence for conviction for an offense, relief shall be granted only on the following grounds. The conviction was obtained in violation of the Constitution of the United States or the state of Louisiana. The court exceeded its jurisdiction. The conviction or sentence subjected him to double jeopardy. The limitations on the institution of prosecution had expired. The statute creating the offense for which he was convicted and sentenced is unconstitutional. The conviction or sentence constitute the ex post facto application of law in violation of the Constitution of the United States or the state of Louisiana. Two more to go. The results of DNA testing performed pursuant to an application granted under Article 926.1 provides by clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner is factually innocent of the crime for which he was convicted. And then finally, the petitioner is determined by clear and convincing evidence to be factually innocent under Article 926.2. This is a real mess. So then what's next?
Well, before I get to what's next, looking at this list, none of these would have given this guy relief because it was new evidence. The statute is not unconstitutional, so therefore he wouldn't have won on that. It was not double jeopardy. The statute of limitations hadn't expired. No DNA testing revealed anything. So therefore, of all these grounds, none of those would have worked. So we would have an unjust conviction, which has been reinstated. The original life without parole has been reinstated. What next? I'm not sure if there's any avenues for Mr. Lee. The state Supreme Court is the final decider on the state's constitution. And clemency is not a constitutional right as far as I'm aware of. So therefore, he doesn't really have any other options that come to mind. We might need to ask a Louisiana attorney, but I'm not thinking of any.
All right. And then bring this back around for me, please. How did you relate this to PFRs?
Well, if you have been convicted in a situation where new evidence has surfaced, you're doomed now because you have to go to the governor. What would be the chances of the governor giving a PFR relief?
I see. Yeah, no kidding. I can't imagine under only obvious, like the you were, there's video evidence, everything, DNA showing that you're innocent, that you would get it. And somehow you get the judge, the governor's soft side, and they pardon you somehow.
So, well, I think we've just about covered our agenda.
I believe that we did. You have like 75 articles here that we're not going to touch a single one of them.
That's right, because we're at 58 minutes already.
Yes, we are, especially then when I got to edit out my little flub. Do you have anything that you would like to address before we leave?
I think we're going to be taking 1 week off this month. I looked at the calendar. We've got 5 Saturdays, and there's no way in the world I can do 5 weeks in 1 month.
I think you can. You can if I say you will. How about that?
I'll see about that.
You'll see about that. I do want to mention that we did get a new patron. It was funny, Larry. I don't want to bag on the person that did the contribution because it was really awesome that they did it. But it came across and the notification was really small and the decimal was in a place. And I was like, holy crap, we got one of those what were those checks? The relief checks during COVID? What were those called?
$1,400.
Stimulus. It looked like that to me. But then when I actually looked at it, it was like, oh, no. But anyway, David, thank you for becoming a patron. I really, really appreciate it. It is amazing. I just read it wrong. My eyes were sleepy or something. I was like, oh, never mind. But I appreciate it nonetheless. Every number counts. I do appreciate it. I'm just telling you a story. So thank you very much for becoming a patron. And we did have a listener reach out, Larry, that is sad that we may be discontinuing the transcription service and wanted to offer help in some form or fashion. So please, if you are interested in helping us with the transcripts, which takes a handful of hours every week, and you get to listen very thoroughly and very deeply to the podcast, that you would then help us create a magnificent, accurate reproduction of the show. And you, Larry, you have one real strong requirement of someone doing the transcript.
It's really strange, but I actually want the person to listen to the playback.
that seems like a lot to ask for, apparently.
And that means that you'll be looking at the auto-generated text and comparing it to what you're hearing, and you'll be pressing pause and correcting it, because we call it a transcript, meaning it should replicate as close as reasonably possible to what we're saying. And the automation only gets so much of it right, and therefore, without listening to it, you can't get an accurate transcript, and we can't charge people money for something that doesn't represent what we're saying.
So if you are interested, it would be amazing if you could participate. And there may be pay in there for you, too. Like, seriously, you might be able to get paid. So, without further ado, just to let everyone know, if you do become a patron, you're afforded the privilege of listening to the podcast as we record it live, and that opens up the opportunity for you to chat with Larry or get active in our Discord server, and then you can chat with all of our crazy people, because there's some interesting conversations that go on. And that's over at patreon.com/registrymatters for as little as a dollar a month to become a patron. And like I said, so we record at 7 p.m. Eastern on Saturday nights. You can find all the show notes over at registrymatters.co, and then you can leave voicemail, which nobody's done in a little while, but 747-227-4477 if you want to speak and be on the program. Those are much better to play than me reading, because it at least adds a little variety and color into the program. And then if you want to email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com, and I already gave you the Patreon address, so patreon.com/registrymatters. I don't have anything else, sir. Do you have anything else?
I think we can wrap it up.
Very good. I hope you have a fantastic weekend, Larry, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.